Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
I had said that we were going to start today some of his thoughts explicitly on the priesthood. I decided to move it around a little bit. We'll do that in both of the conferences tomorrow. But because of the day that we are marking today, with regard to our charity toward the least among us, growing in the womb, I have brought forward a conference on Pope Francis and loving service. The type of formation of all of us to be good Samaritans to everyone. The fundamental reform of the Church, according to Pope Francis, as we've been talking about, is to allow the Lord once again to shape us into, or reshape us into, an evangelizing Church. Church doesn't have a mission, but is a mission. Pope Francis says in his apostolic exhortation that none of us either has a mission, but each of us similarly is the continuation of the Lord's mission. I am a mission, Pope Francis writes. That mission involves going to preach the gospel to the peripheries, not just in terms of geography, but those who are left on the margins of existence. It means preaching the gospel to the poor, to the unwanted, to the discarded, to the abandoned. Means inviting not those who can repay us, but as Jesus said twice in different parts of the gospel, the poor, crippled, blind, and lame who can't repay us. The fundamental corruption of the Church, Pope Francis has been saying since before his election, is when the Church gets so focused on herself and those who are already coming, those who are already contributing, that we can forget about others. We care for the sheep in the fold, but don't remember that the Lord has other sheep that are not presently in that visible fold. We don't care adequately, or sometimes at all, for those people whom we don't encounter, who may be suffering enormously because of the absence of Christ in their life, the absence of love, the absence of some material support. And this is in everything. Pope Francis is trying to lead the reform of the Church, not principally by words, but by his body language. He himself has been going to the peripheries. He's gone to refugee centers where those were treated or even called alien, as if they were from some other planet, are often subjected to terrible conditions. He's gone to jail to care for incarcerated teens in whom no one has much hope for reform, but he hasn't lost hope. He's gone to children's hospitals to care for those who are suffering, including with terminal sentences. He's gone to poor villages and even poor homes in order to bring hope to the poor, drinking even at breakfast a little cachaça, a little moonshine, along with his espressos when he visited the favela of Varginha outside of Rio. He's identified with the poor, living very simply both before and after his papal election. Buenos Aires, taking simple transportation, and identifying very much with the poor and the simple he's trying to serve, living in a simple room, which is probably smaller than any of our suites in our rectory. I once, because I participated in a Vatican conference, stayed in the Domus. His room's 201, mine was just a couple down the hall, and I know how big that room was. I mean, it was nice in the sense that in Rome, you always get marble, but you almost never get wood. There was wood on the inside, which was a little strange and a little bit higher, but the rooms weren't very big. Not many rooms for not much room for books or anything else, but that's where he is. He's changed the papal almoner's office to go out and actively find the poor and help them in small but concrete ways. He's gone out into the crowd in search not of royalty or celebrities, but for those who the world not only considers nobodies but burdens. He's embraced handicapped adults and kids. He's allowed a Downs teen to ride in the Popemobile with him. And in probably the most iconic scene of his papacy, he embraced even those whom charitable people would have found physically revolting. You probably remember that photo of the embrace with Vinicio Rivas, who had his neurofibromatotic tumors all over his face. 53 years old, from the Italian town of Vicenza, he suffered, even within the church, a lifetime of hurt and misunderstanding because of his being covered from head to toe with ugly, itchy, odoriferous sores that bleed into his clothes every day and out of his skin. In early November, he traveled with his aunt and others from Vicenza to the Vatican. He was in a wheelchair. Because he was in a wheelchair, he had just the general admission ticket. They kept waving him up and waving him up and waving him up and waving him up. And he and his aunt, Carla Lotto, Caterina Lotto, were able to go up there basically right to the front row. And this is what his aunt said. When he came close to us, meaning the Pope, I thought that he would just give me his hand. Instead, he went straight to Vinicio and embraced him tightly. I thought he wouldn't give him back to me. He held him so tightly. We didn't speak. We said nothing, but he looked at me as if he was digging deep inside, a beautiful look I would have never expected. And Vinicio said in an Italian paper, he didn't have any fear of my illness. I'm not contagious, but the Pope didn't know that. There were two types of these fibromatotic tumors, type 1 and type 2. One isn't contagious, the other is very contagious. You can't really distinguish them by sight. Even if the Pope knew what he was dealing with, he probably didn't. He fearlessly went ahead. He didn't have any fear of my illness. I'm not contagious, but the Pope didn't know it. But he did it, period. He caressed my whole face. And while he was doing it, I felt only love. It lasted a little longer than a minute, but it felt as if it were an eternity. I quivered. I felt great warmth. He said it brought about a great change in him. I feel stronger and so much happier now. I feel I can move ahead because the Lord is protecting me. And when he hasn't physically been able to get out to the peripheries himself, Pope Francis has been using something we all have in order to still go to the peripheries. He called Carlos Samiri, his 81-year-old cobbler in Buenos Aires, to inquire about his shoe repair and just to say thank you for all his years of service and telling him somebody else would get his shoes. Telephoned his newspaper man, Daniel Del Reno, to cancel his subscription, to thank him for delivering his newspaper faithfully to him for 30 years. He called his Argentine dentist to cancel the appointment, as if the dentist wouldn't have known the news because he couldn't keep the appointment. He famously tried to call the Superior General of the Jesuits in order to thank him for his kind letter, but the young Jesuit of the switchboard didn't believe he was the Pope and said, when he said, sono il Papa, he said, et io sono Napoleano, and I'm Napoleon. It's becoming clear, however, that Pope Francis has found another type of use for the phone. He's using it as a bridge to reach out to those on the fringes. Just a few. On August 7th, he called Michele Ferri, who had written him for prayers because he was finding it impossible to forgive the two men who had murdered his brother Andrea in Pesaro, Italy. Francis called him, told him he cried reading his letter, comforted him about the death of his brother, encouraged him to forgive, and then asked him if he'd be kind enough to get his mother so that he would be able to extend to her his deepest sympathies as well. On August 18th, he telephoned Stefano Cabizza, a 19-year-old computer student from Padova, worried about finding a job after graduation. He had tried to see the Pope in Castel Gandolfo when the Pope was celebrating the Assumption Mass there, but he wasn't able to get close to him, but he just put a letter into a cardinal's hand and begged him to give it to the Pope. The cardinal did. He never expected a telephone call, though. Pope called the first time in the middle of the afternoon asking for Stefano. No, he's not here. Who's this? He said, well, I don't want to tell you, but do you know when he'll be back? He'll be back later. So he called back later, and Stefano still wasn't there. Pope patiently said, listen, this is an important phone call. Can you find Stefano and just let him know that I'll call him back at 8? Sure. Who's this? You'll find out later. Nobody recognized the voice. At 8 o'clock, he called, and he finally reached Stefano and talked for 8 minutes, and Stefano couldn't believe that the Pope was calling him. And one very, I think, illustrative part of this conversation, which, again, is part of the whole reform of honorific titles in the church, like Monsignor, is when Stefano was constantly calling him Lei, which is the very formal address in Italian, like Usted in Spanish, or Vosé in Portuguese, or Vous in French. Lei is the formal, tu is the informal. And Stefano, for obvious reasons, was using the lay form with the Pope. And the Pope said, no, Stefano, you can use tu with me. And Stefano just couldn't believe it. I can't use tu with the Holy Father. And he said, do you think Jesus had the apostles call him Your Excellency? And so, you know, I mean, Stefano is the guy who reveals all of this stuff. This isn't released from the Vatican. But reaching on out to help this guy have confidence. On August 25th, he telephoned Alejandra Pereira, a 44-year-old Argentinian mother of six who had written him, describing that she had been raped by a police officer at gunpoint in his cruiser, but that the police department was covering up the rape and had actually promoted the officer in question. Pope Francis spent a half hour with her, patiently listening to her story. He encouraged her to be calm and reminded her she was never alone. She said the encounter gave her back her faith, her confidence, and the courage to continue seeking justice. On November 1st, he called a fierce critic of his liturgical practices, Mario Palmaro, the protagonists of the old right in Italy who thought that Pope Benedict was the Messiah, have had a very difficult time with Pope Francis, even though there's really no liturgical abuse that we're talking about or anything. But nevertheless, Mario Palmaro had written very critically. And Pope Francis found out that he had stage 4 cancer, so he tracked down his number and he called him. He thanked him for his criticism and told him he was praying for him as he battled with his terminal diagnosis. Palmaro said in an interview afterward, I was astonished, I was amazed, above all moved. For me as a Catholic, that which I was experiencing was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. When Mario tried to clarify the motivations of his recent work, to say, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, Holy Father, I didn't mean to overstep, the Pope didn't let him finish his sentence. He said that he understood that those criticisms had been made with love and how important it was for him as Pope to have received them. Perhaps the most moving of all happened on September 3rd. Pope Francis called Anna Romano, a 35-year-old Roman woman whose boyfriend, after she told him she was pregnant, divulged that he was married and tried to persuade her to have an abortion. She wrote in anguish to the Pope asking for his prayers. He called. He spoke to her as a friend, again with the two, mentioned how strong and brave she was in keeping her baby. And as she told an Italian newspaper, he reassured me, telling me the baby was a gift from God, a sign of providence. And he told me I would not be left alone. After she said she was worried because she's a divorcee, and for that reason she worried that she might not be able to find a priest to baptize her baby, Pope Francis told her he was sure she would be able to find a willing pastor. But if not, you know, there's always me. He's not, in doing this, a conventional liberal or a conventional conservative, to use the political category that never really fit anyone in the church. He's not pushing for the government to find a solution for everything. He's rather telling us to give others something to eat. He's not saying that it all has to happen by private charity either, saying rather it's a thing of justice and that individual handouts are never going to suffice. He's exceeding both of these categories. To many, especially in affluent areas of the West, while his example is inspiring, his words are too challenging to handle. He's truly seeking to get us to love our neighbor in deeds rather than just talking about loving our neighbor. What I'd like to do in this conference is to tackle how he's seeking to reform the whole church and all of us in the church particularly we servant leaders as priests in the church, to make our love for our neighbor much more practical. Pope Francis is convinced that this is essential for the reform of the church and for the fulfillment of the mission that is the church. So there'll be a handful of points. First, the Pope has stressed that the structural reform of the church must come after a change in attitude to make the whole church a good Samaritan rather than an association of ecclesiocrats. In that interview with Father Antonio Spadaro in September, he said, "How are we treating the people of God? I dream of a church that's a mother and a shepherdess. The church's ministers must be merciful, take responsibility for the people, and accompany them like the Good Samaritan who washes, cleans, and raises up his neighbor. That's our job description. Merciful, take responsibility for the people, neither lax or rigid, and accompany them like the Good Samaritan who washes, cleans, and lifts our neighbor up. This is pure gospel. The structural and organizational reforms are secondary. That is, they come afterward. The first reform must be the attitude. The ministers of the gospel must be people who can warm the hearts of the people because they can sense the warmth of that love, who walk through the dark night with them, who know how to dialogue and to descend into their people's night, into their darkness, but without getting lost. Beautiful sort of poetic point there in prose. We need to enter into our people's darkness, into their fears, to their horrors, into their pain, but with the light of Christ, not getting lost, so that we can guide them out of the cave. The people of God, he says, want pastors, not clergy acting like bureaucrats or government officials. The bishops particularly must be able to support the movements of God among their people with patience so that no one is left behind. You know, sometimes we can behave that way. We can behave like government bureaucrats in different clothing. Sometimes we can behave as politicians. It always wounds the people. Pope Francis is trying to set a totally different example. And in each of these areas, he's not saying, do what I say, but he's saying, follow me. That's literally what he's doing. He's entering into the people's darkness, like the phone calls that I've just described. But with the light of Christ, never getting lost, so that he can give them the direction out. Good Samaritan, helping them along the way. In his homily at his inaugural Mass, he stressed that our authentic priestly power is for service. And the way we grow more powerful is through serving. It said, certainly Jesus conferred power upon Peter. But what sort of power was it? Jesus' three questions to Peter about love are followed by three commands. Feed my sheep. Feed my lamb. Tend my sheep. Let us never forget that authentic power is service. And that the Pope too, when exercising power, must enter ever more fully into that service which has its radiant culmination on the cross. He must be inspired by the lovely, concrete, and faithful service that marks St. Joseph and like him. He must open his arms to protect all of God's people and embrace with tender affection the whole of humanity, especially the poorest, the weakest, the least important, those whom Matthew lists in the final judgment on love, the hungry, the thirsty, the stranger, the naked, the sick, and those in prison. Only those who serve with love are able to protect and defend. You know, it's quite clear that for Pope Francis, these words in Matthew 25 aren't words. They're a way of life. To care for those whom nobody else cares for, the poorest, the weakest, the least important, those who are in need of the corporal works of mercy. But it's not just a service for the Pope, obviously. It's a service that all of us must seek to give. But he says, priests and bishops are even more summoned to this service by the Lord and should seek to do it from the heart. When he visited on Holy Thursday, that Casal de Marmo, to celebrate the Del Marmo, to celebrate the Mass for those incarcerated teens. In very simple, down-to-earth language, he said in his brief homily, Jesus himself explains to his disciples, do you know what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right, for that's what I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've set you an example that you should also do as I've done you. The Pope comments, it's the Lord's example. He is the most important, and he washes feet, because with us, what is highest must be at the service of others. This is a symbol, it's a sign, right? Washing feet means I'm at your service. And with us too, don't we have to wash each other's feet day after day? What does that mean? That all of us must help one another. Help one another. This is what Jesus teaches us, and this is what I'm doing. And doing with all my heart, because it's my duty. As a priest and a bishop, I must be at your service. But it's a duty that comes from my heart. I love it. I love this, and I love to do it, because that is what the Lord has taught me to do. Now we will perform the ceremony washing feet. Let us each think, let every one of us think, am I really willing to serve, to help others? And let us think that this is a sign of the caress of Jesus, which Jesus gives, because this is the real reason why Jesus came, to serve us and to help us. To be a priest means I am at your service. That's what our body language should be screaming. Not get out of my presence, you're irksome to me. Just the way sometimes, honestly, we feel. But that I'm at your service, and particularly at the service of the lame, the blind, the crippled, not the beautiful people. We don't neglect them. But to a large degree, they're always going to have people to care for them. It's the people who have no one to care for them that the Pope is calling us to have a special care for. This type of service to which he's summoning us all comes from a new form of hearing, he says. That if we're truly listening to the voice of the Lord, then with him we will hear the cry of the poor. We will hear the cry of our brothers and sisters in need. And we will learn how to cry with them. If Pope Francis is Pope to the age of 100, he will never give a more powerful homily than he did on July 7th, when he went to Lampedusa, that little island off the coast of Sicily, where over the last 25 years, 20,000 people have perished trying to make the journey. I don't know if you've ever studied what's really going on with Lampedusa. Mainly Eritrean and Ethiopians are trying to escape from brutal persecution in those countries. We have our coyotes at the Mexican border, and you know, they're compensated quite well to try to get people across the border. The boats that take people the 70-mile journey cost the equivalent in US dollars $40,000. You have to raise the equivalent of $40,000 to get on that boat. Boats wouldn't pass inspection in our country. A lot of the times they're fit to have about 30 people on them, and they jam 150 to 200. And many of them perish. We've had various shipwrecks just this year. And after one at the very end of June, Pope Francis said, I have to go, and I have to bring the attention of the world here. It was his first trip outside of Rome. Wanted to lay a wreath where they died. The terrible details of that is it capsized close. And Lampedusa has a huge rock cliff on one side. There was a pregnant woman with her pregnant baby trying to survive in the water as the boat was being pushed by the waves and crushed her and her unborn child to death across next to on those sort of rock cliffs. And he went there and he gave these words. So going to read it. It's a little bit more extended than a typical quotation, but we'll do some glosses because this ought to scar us. God's two questions today echo as forcefully as ever. Where is your brother? His blood is crying out to me. How many of us, myself included, have lost our bearings? We're no longer attentive to the world in which we live. We don't care. We don't protect what God created for everyone. And we end up unable even to care for one another. And when humanity as a whole loses its bearings, it results in tragedies like the one we have witnessed. Where is your brother? His blood cries out to me, says the Lord. This is not a question directed toward others. It's a question directed to me, to you, to each of us. These brothers and sisters of ours were trying to escape difficult situations to find some serenity and peace. They were looking for a better place for themselves and their families, but instead, they found death. How often do such people fail to find understanding, fail to find acceptance, fail to find solidarity, and their cry rises up to God? He then thanked the people of Lampedusa for their solidarity. He said, "Before I came out to Mass, I listened to one of these brothers of ours. He and the others were at the mercy of traffickers, people who exploit the poverty of others, who live off the misery of others. How much these people have suffered, and so many have never even made it here. Where is your brother? Who is responsible for this blood?" And then, you know, he was a literature professor when he was teaching in the Collegio, high school English. And he told the comedy of Lope de Vega that tells how the town of Fuente Ovejuna killed their governor because the governor is a tyrant. They do it in such a way that no one knows who the actual killer is. So when the royal judge says, "¿Quién mató el gobernador?" Who killed the governor? They all reply, "Fuente Ovejuna, señor." The town killed him, sir. Everybody and nobody, the Pope said. Today, too, the question has to be asked, who's responsible for the blood of these brothers and sisters of ours? And the response is, nobody! This is our answer. It isn't me. I don't have anything to do with it. It must be someone else. It's certainly not me. Yet God is asking each of us, where is the blood of your brother that is crying out to me? Today, no one in our world feels responsible. We've lost a sense of responsibility for our brothers and sisters. We've fallen into the hypocrisy of the priest and the Levite whom Jesus described in the parable of the Good Samaritan. We see our brother half dead on the side of the road, and perhaps we say, "Poor guy," but then go on our way. It's not our responsibility. And with that, we feel assuaged and reassured. The culture of comfort, which makes us think only of ourselves, makes us insensitive to the cries of other people, makes us live in soap bubbles that, however lovely, are insubstantial. They offer a fleeting and empty illusion that results in indifference to others. Indeed, it leads to the globalization of indifference. In our globalized world, we've fallen into a globalized indifference. It should be the other way around. When you see people suffering, it should make us more sensitive. We've become habituated to it. We've fallen into this globalized indifference. We've become used to the suffering of others. It no longer affects me. It doesn't concern me. It's none of my business. And then he finished. "Adam, where are you? Where is your brother?" These are the two questions that God asks at the dawn of human history, in which He also asks each man and each woman today. But I'd like to ask a third question. Has any one of us wept because of this situation, others like it? Has any one of us grieved for the death of these brothers and sisters? Has any one of us wept for the persons who were on the boat, for the young mothers carrying their babies, for these men who were looking for a means of supporting their households? We're a society that's forgotten how to weep, how to experience compassion, how to suffer with others. That's what compasio means, to suffer with others. The globalization of indifference has taken from us the ability to weep. In the gospel, we've heard the crying, the wailing, the great lamentation. Rachel weeps for her children because they are no more. Herod sowed death to protect his own comfort, his own soap bubble. And so it continues. Let us ask the Lord to remove the part of Herod that lurks in our hearts. Let us ask the Lord for the grace to weep over our indifference, to weep over the cruelty of our world, over our own hearts, and of all those who in anonymity make social and economic decisions that open the door to tragic situations like this. Has anyone wept? Today, has anyone wept in our world? That's how we finished. If we truly have compassion, we're going to weep, including the strongest guys. We'll weep. Pope Francis admitted that he had wept over what happened in Lampedusa. And he sprung into action. He couldn't solve the entire problem. He doesn't have that in his power. But he could do something about it. Who's responsible for the blood of these unborn? Fuente Ovejuna, Señor? Supreme Court? The bad guys? Have we wept? Have we been able to sleep easily at night knowing what happens every 23 seconds? How about the poor? About those committing suicide today because they think nobody gives a shit? Nobody cares. God's world, Pope Francis stresses in contrast, is one in which we take responsibility for others. We own up to a responsiveness for somebody else. In the vigil for prayer for peace in Syria on September 7th, he said, God's world is a world where everyone feels responsible for the other, for the good of the other. This is the kingdom we're proclaiming. This is the kingdom we're supposed to be living in. This is the kingdom we're trying to go out and bring others into. A world in which everyone feels responsible for the other, for the good of the other. Is this really the world, however, I desire? Is this really the world that we carry in our hearts? Is this the world in which we're living? When man thinks only of himself, of his own interests, and places himself in the center, when he permits himself to be captivated by the idols of dominion and power, when he puts himself in God's place, then all relationships are broken and everything is ruined. And that opens the door to violence and difference and conflict. This is precisely what the passage of the book of Genesis seeks to teach us in the story of the fall. It's exactly in this chaos that God asked man's conscience, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And Cain responds, "How the hell should I know? Am I my brother's keeper?" We too are asked this question. And it would be good for us to ask ourselves this question often. Am I really my brother's keeper? Yes, you are your brother's keeper. To be human means to care for one another. But when harmony is broken, a metamorphosis occurs. The brother who is to be cared for and loved becomes an adversary, somebody to fight, to kill. What violence occurs at that moment? How many conflicts, how many wars have marked our history? We need only to look at the suffering of so many brothers and sisters. This isn't a question of coincidence. This is the truth. We bring about the rebirth of Cain in every act of violence and war. We all do. And even today we continue the history of conflict between brothers. Even today we raise our hands against our brother. Even today we let ourselves be guided by idols, by selfishness, by our own interests. And this attitude persists. This is what's behind abortion. We have perfected our weapons. Our conscience is falling asleep, though. And we've sharpened our ideas in order to be able to justify ourselves against that conscience. As if it were normal, we continue to sow destruction, pain, and death. Powerful words. We bring about that rebirth of Cain. But the kingdom we're called to live in and announce is a kingdom in which we're not selfish. We're not dominated by our idols, by our own interests, by our own attitudes. But that we sacrifice for somebody else. We feel responsible for that person. We put the other person ahead of ourselves. Just like Jesus put us ahead of himself, taking our place in death row. And he said, "Follow me. Do this in memory of me. I've done this as an example, so that just as I have done for you, so you also may do. As St. John recognized in his first letter, if Christ has died for us, then that means we too must die for each other. At a very practical level, we must make our neighbor's welfare part of our business. We have to have that holy permission to stick our nose into other people's business, to try to help them in a good and charitable way. When he visited in Rio, St. Francis of Assisi Hospital, he said to the people present there, in the Gospel we read the parable of the Good Samaritan that speaks of a man assaulted by robbers and left half dead on the side of the road. People pass by and look at him, but they don't stop. They just continue on their journey, indifferent to him. It's none of their business. How often we say, not my problem. How often we turn the other way and pretend not to see. Only a Samaritan, a stranger, sees him, stops, lifts him up, takes him by the hand and cares for him. You know, we need to get into that scene of the Good Samaritan a little bit more. You know, if we were to update it, you know, we've heard the term so often that they no longer strike us. But the real way the parable works is, somebody was left for dead on the side of the road. A bishop's walking by and the bishop just says, I'm late. A missionary of charity is passing by. Missionary of charity just continues to walk. And then a level 4 sex offender passes by. A drug dealer passes by. And he crosses the road. And he actually cares for the person who's wounded. A prostitute crossed the road and cares for the one who is wounded. When Jesus used that word Samaritan, he was talking about the worst example you could have for a Jew to illustrate his point. If prostitutes and drug dealers and sex offenders would cross the road and care, and a lot of the times they do. You know, when we care for the homeless, we recognize that a lot of the times it's the homeless who are their best friends, the ones who will always be there. Their fellow drug addicts will be the ones who will actually sacrifice their meager portions because they know this person might need it more. If they'll do it, what about us? Jesus calls us specifically to this type of charity. And he tells us very clearly that we're going to be judged by it. Not because he wants to judge us harshly, but because we actually judge ourselves by our own actions. It'll be his word that judges us. In a catechesis at the very end of November, thinking about death and about judgment, he says, against this horizon of judgment, we understand Jesus' invitation to be always ready, watchful, knowing that life in this world is given to us in order to prepare for the afterlife, for life with the Heavenly Father. And for this, there is a sure path, preparing oneself well for death, staying close to Jesus. This is surety. I prepare myself for death by staying close to Jesus. And how do I stay close to Jesus? Through prayer, in the sacraments, and also in the exercise of charity. Just pause there for a second. How do I stay close to Jesus? Prayer, sacrament, exercise of charity. Let us remember that he's present in the weakest and most needy. He identified himself with them in the well-known parable of the Last Judgment, which he said, I was hungry, thirsty, naked, stranger, ill, and in prison, and he cared for me. As you did for one of the least of my brothers and sisters, you did for me. Therefore, a sure path comes by recovering the meaning of Christian charity and fraternal sharing, by caring for the bodily and spiritual wounds of our neighbor. Solidarity in sharing sorrow and infusing hope is a premise and a condition for receiving as an inheritance that kingdom that's been prepared for us. The one who really practices mercy doesn't fear death. Think well on this, the Holy Father said. The one who practices mercy doesn't fear death. And then he asks, siate de accordo? Do you agree? Shall we not say it together so as not to forget it? He loves to do this. He asks them all to repeat after me. The one who practices mercy doesn't fear death. And he asks, Why doesn't he fear death? Because he looks death in the face in the wounds of his brothers and sisters, and he overcomes it with the love of Jesus Christ. If we'll open the door of our lives and our hearts to our littlest brothers and sisters, then even our own death will become a door that introduces us to heaven, to that blessed homeland toward which we are directed, longing to dwell forever with God our Father, with Jesus, with Our Lady, and with the saints. We prepare for our death by charity. You know, the great saints have said that the only real IRA we should be focused on is charity. The only money we can take with us is not the stuff we store away in a Cayman's account. The only money we can take with us is what we actually put into the hands of the poor. John Vianney used to say, the poor are our bankers. He said, all that we have is just a divine depository placed in our hands. God just makes us stewards of His own gifts, calling us to give over to others. St. John Vianney's great thing was what he called his shuttle pocket in his cassock. You know, because whatever came in left that very day. Mm-hmm. And every night he could, he would count. I mean, he'd give out several hundred francs a day, and he'd have a few sous sometimes left over, and he'd say to Frère Athanas, this is what I've got for tomorrow to be able to give out. He's just constantly giving everything that he had. Say, I'd sell all my teeth if it'd be able to help the poor. I'd give my body if it weren't so emaciated and somebody would pay a sou for it. Give even my body over to be able to help those in need. By the end of his life, he was single-handedly supporting 30 poor families. You know, he'd always, when it would come to November, he'd start to save some money because he knew come January he was going to have to pay the rent for these farms for 30 whole families. I just need to be blunt on this point. We are really wealthy as priests compared to the priests anywhere else in the world. We really are wealthy. There's a lot that we're capable of giving. Putting kids through school when their parents can't afford a Catholic education. We can do lots of things anonymously. The priests who give very generously recognize that they really do get a hundredfold in this life. And the Lord continues to give them more and more and more and more money. You don't know where it comes from, but it just shows up so that you can give more and more. He who is faithful in those little things will be faithful in bigger things, and the Lord will give us bigger charity. It's one of the great joys of being a diocesan priest, by the way. One of the big challenges of being religious is you don't own anything. When you don't own anything, it's very hard to give anything away. But as secular priests, we do own some stuff, and we can therefore give it away. What a great joy it is, and a great participation in God's own liberality. When we give alms, Pope Francis says we should do so respecting other people's dignity. You know, whenever St. John Vianney would give out charity, he'd trade. He'd say, I noticed that you've got those little piece of bread there, and I'm really hungry. Could I buy them off of you? Well, how much would you give me? How about 5 francs? For this little piece of bread, I'm really hungry. Okay. And to try to keep the dignity so that somebody wasn't just receiving a handout. He said something about his way of hearing confessions in a Pentecost vigil with Ecclesial Movements on May 18th. He said, when I go to hear confessions, well, I can't now, but when I used to go to hear confessions, people would come to me and I would always ask them, do you give alms? I'd always ask that in every confession. Are you giving alms? Yes, Father. Very good, he'd say. Then I would ask him 2 further questions. Tell me, when you do give alms, do you look the person in the eye? I don't know, Father. I haven't really thought about it. Second question. And when you give alms, do you touch the hand of the person you're giving them to? Or do you just kind of toss or drop the coin at him or her? He said, this is the problem. The flesh of Christ, touching the flesh of Christ, taking upon ourselves the suffering of the poor. Poverty for us Christians is not sociological, philosophical, or cultural. It's theological. I'll explain that point later. I might say, this is the first category because our God, the Son of God, abased Himself. He made Himself poor to walk along the road with us. To always respect that human dignity of a brother or a sister, not just a recipient of a handout, but as somebody deserving of love. And if we're really going to love our neighbor, it demands our willingness to give our life for them. In a homily in the middle of May, he said, Jesus says something remarkable to us in his new commandment. He said, greater love no man has than this, to lay down his life for his friends. Love always takes this path, to give one's life. To live life as a gift to be given, not a treasure to be stored. And Jesus lived in this way as a gift. And if we live lives as a gift, we do what Jesus wanted. I appointed you to go and bear fruit. So we must not burn out our life with selfishness, but we must rediscover it with self-giving. Not counting the cost. The way we become true Good Samaritans. The church today, Pope Francis is saying, must sing a new song of service. You know, when we're always saying Cantico Domino, Canticum Novum, we'll sing to the Lord a new song. It's not like the words are different, but the tunes can be different. In every age, we must sing a new song, particularly of charity today in the church. World Youth Day with the kids, in his 3 points, his third point was to serve. This was the main homily on the last final mass of World Youth Day. He said, the opening words of the psalm that we proclaimed are, sing to the Lord a new song. What is this new song? Doesn't consist in words. It's not a melody. It's the song of your life. It's allowing our life to be identified with Jesus' life. It's sharing His sentiments, His thoughts, His actions. And the life of Jesus is a life for others. Evangelizing means bearing personal witness to the love of God, overcoming our selfishness, and serving by bending down to wash the feet of our brethren, just as Jesus did. That must be the new song that the church sings. This is the way we recover from scandals. A little bit of a personal story. When Bishop O'Malley was the bishop in the Virgin Islands, after he had been there for a while, he got a letter, believe it or not, from the nuncio, not a phone call, appointing him to Fall River to help solve the mess there after the terrible clergy sex abuse scandal of Father James Porter, which those of you who are a little older might remember. The first notorious one was Gilbert Goeth in Lafayette. The second was James Porter in 1991-1992 during the interregnum at Fall River. And the third was Boston in 2002. But when Bishop O'Malley was there, he was wise enough to recognize that the only way you recuperate the church's reputation is by charity. So while he was still there in the Virgin Islands, he called up Blessed Mother Teresa. He knew her from Catholic University when he was there running El Centro Catolico. He just said, Mother, the Holy Father's asked me to go to Fall River, and I can't do it without your sisters. Because we have to show the true face of the church. The face of the church is not a bunch of abusers. The face of the church are those who really live by the gospel, live by the truth, live by God's command to love each other as Christ has loved us first. And that's why I need dramatically to show the people throughout Massachusetts this real face of the church as your missionaries of charity do. Blessed Mother Teresa sent those sisters, and I've been their guide. But that's what we always need to do here in Minnesota, after what's been coming out through Minnesota NPR and everything else like this. What we most need is to show the true face of the church, which is charity. We must sing that new song, and we must sing it not as a whole bunch of cacophonous people singing their own tunes. We need to sing it in a beautiful choir, because people will always notice that charity. That's what they can't resist. That's why Pope Francis is so irresistible. And that's why the people who really hate the church want to destroy the church's charity. It was true for Julian the Apostate. It's true for Barack the Apostate. He'd rather shut down Catholic hospitals and food pantries and Catholic schools than not have us pay for abortions. Think about that for a second. Charity's always the way. The church is meant to be a communion of charity. In November 6th catechesis, he said that the church is sancta sanctis, holy things among holy people. But the most important thing of all is our love. Without love, even the most extraordinary gifts are in vain. St. Paul says, even if he gives his body over to the torturers as a martyr, but doesn't have love, he gains nothing. This man heals people, he has that power, this other virtue, but does he have love and charity in his heart? If he does, then all is well. But if he doesn't, he's no servant of the church. Without love, no gift or charism could serve the church. For where there's not love, there's an emptiness that becomes filled with selfishness. I'll confess to you what my greatest fear is as a priest. That at the end of my life, everybody will say, he was really smart. But they won't say he was good. They won't say he was charitable. They won't say that he really sacrificed for me and gave me his underpants when I asked for the shirt off his back. Pope Francis says we have to wake up the world with our charity. The very end of November is when he was meeting with all the religious men and women throughout the world, and when he surprised us all by saying, beginning next year, we're going to have a year of religious, just like we've just finished the year of faith. He was calling the religious superiors of the world to bring their communities to wake up the world with our charity. He said the witness that can really attract is the one associated with attitudes that are uncommon: generosity, detachment, sacrifice, self-forgetfulness in order to care for others. This is the witness. This is the martyrdom of religious life. It sounds an alarm for people, waking them up. Religious say to people with their life, what's happening? These people are telling me something. The church, therefore, must be attractive. Wake up the world. Be witnesses of a different way of doing things, of acting, of living. Because it's possible to live differently in this world. It's possible to live with generosity, detachment, sacrifice, self-forgetfulness in the care of others. We're all part of that too. To wake up the world with the charity. For us, Mary is a great model of charity. Shows us how to do it with faith. On October 23rd in the catechesis, he described Mary as the model of charity. In what way is Mary a living example of love for the church? He asked and answered. Let us think about the readiness she showed to her cousin Elizabeth. In visiting her, the Virgin Mary brought not only material help, she brought this too, but she also brought Jesus, who was already alive in her womb. Bringing Jesus into that house meant bringing joy, the fullness of joy. Elizabeth and Zechariah were rejoicing in a pregnancy that seemed impossible at their age, but it was the young Mary who brought them the fullness of joy, the joy that comes from Jesus and the Holy Spirit and is expressed by gratuitous charity, by sharing with, helping, and understanding others. Our Lady also wants to bring the great gift of Jesus to us, to us all. And with Him she brings us His love, His peace, His joy. In this, the Church is like Mary. The Church isn't a shop. It's not a humanitarian agency. It's not an NGO. The Church is sent to bring Christ and His Gospel to all. She doesn't bring herself, whether small or great, strong or weak. The Church carries Jesus and should be like Mary when she went to visit Elizabeth. That's charity. And in Evangelii Gaudium, the Pope has this massive section on charity. Not going to go through it, but I just want to return to that sense of charity of the Church being a theological category, the charity specifically toward the poor. Not sociological, not philosophical, theological. Because Christ himself came into this world poor. Even though he was rich, he emptied himself, taking on the form of a slave. He was born poor, put in a poor man's manger. Turtle doves redeemed him. Didn't even have a place to lay his head. Was dependent on the charity of the few women who would follow him around. Died naked upon a cross. Put into another man's grave. Poor. And he said, follow me. There's something really powerful there in the example of Pope Francis. Pope Francis has basically taken those words somewhat literally. That's one of the reasons why he is so free. It's one of the reasons why his example is so powerful. Theological category. And we are supposed to be theologians in that sense. Speaking literally of God. Logos theo. Speaking of God by our own action. And that's what he's really calling. When we begin to frame our whole approach to life and our priesthood in this way, then we begin to really hear the cry of the poor. We begin to hear their needs. We begin to get scandalized when people are suffering. We hear the cry of all peoples. He said, care for the poor is not the mission of the few. Every individual Christian, every parish community is called by God to liberate and promote the poor and help them to become full members of the society. Christians, with the help of their pastors, are called to hear the cry of the poor. We need to tune their ears. For that to occur, our ears first must be attuned. He said, this message is so clear and direct, so simple and eloquent, that no ecclesial interpretation has the right to relativize it. Can't dismiss it. Can't ignore it any longer. You know, and I'm totally guilty of ignoring the real part of it. If somebody comes to me begging, that person gets it. But in terms of going out and searching for the poor, I've stayed behind my computer screen too long. I've let St. Vincent de Paul handle it. It hasn't been personal. I've rested on the laurels of my own generosity for my own particular charities, but there are neighbors more immediate. And he finished that whole section by saying, the worst discrimination against the poor is the lack of spiritual care. Their greatest poverty is often spiritual. Doesn't mean every poor person is spiritual, but the greatest poverty of all is spiritual. That's why Mother Teresa came to the United States. And when she said at Harvard, during her class day address, that America is one of the poorest countries in the world because we are so spiritually impoverished. She specifically spoke about abortion as a sign of our great spiritual poverty, that we don't even recognize the treasure of the child because we're putting our heart in monopoly money of so many different forms. We've got to care for that, give that spiritual care. Our preferential option for the poor must translate into preferential religious care for the poor. We've got to look out for those families that don't really have the ability because of work situations or whatever else in order to be able to follow things more easily and really help them and sensitize our people to it. Let's conclude. That bell's tolling for us, by the way, to be charitable. Let's not let Pope Francis's words remain the subject of a retreat conference. Let's act on him, doing in our own situation what he's doing in his. He gets that his life is a mission, the continuation of the mission of Christ's self-giving love. We have been ordained in persona Christi missionarii caritatis. May we, as his priests, all become true missionaries of charity. And I'll finish with one last story because it's just so powerful. It's a true story. There was a journalist in India traveling on one of the trains throughout the country. And she saw at one of these stops a blind man selling oranges. She noticed that as the train stopped there, one guy got off and he had two heavy suitcases. And as he was rushing to try to get to another track, totally knocked over this man's orange cart. Blind man was trying to search on the ground for his oranges but couldn't find it. A lot of the oranges had run right over to where the track was. So this journalist on the train says, there's no way that this man's going to find them. So gets off the train, starts picking up the oranges as fast as the journalist can and putting them on the cart. Eventually you've got the 1 minute warning on the train. And the guy looks and all his luggage is still there on the train. And looks at this blind man with his whole livelihood rolling all over the K. So he just tells the, be careful, the train's about to leave. And he goes, picks up all the other oranges, brings it as the train's left with his luggage on. And the blind man says to this journalist, was that your train? Yes, it was my train. But you missed your train. Don't worry, another train will come. But why'd you do this? Well, because I was afraid that if I didn't, that you would have, in looking for this, never been able to find your oranges and maybe even been hit by that train as it was leaving. And so then the blind man said to the journalist, is your name Jesus Christ? We are called to be Jesus Christ and continue that mission of charity so that others in seeing us might see Jesus. Glory to the Father and to the Son and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. Saint Vincent de Paul, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.